Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and back with us on Garden Talk today are Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Johnson with us as well, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And Lisa, it's great to have you with us as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
As we talk with our two experts today, I hope you'll join in. We'll zero in a bit on diseases and insects maybe that can threaten your plants. And of course, though, we will take your other gardening questions as well, and I hope you join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Well, weather-wise, certainly been a different gardening season than last year. Lots of rain, Brian, and recently some destructive storms. What should we know about disease and broken branches?
Yeah, the disease that I most worry about for homeowners in associate, well, there are several diseases actually that you could worry about. Oak wilt would be one of them. So that particular, it's a fungal disease. The fungus is moved around by sap beetles, and they are attracted to trees that have been injured. So that could potentially provide an entry point if you've had storm damage to your oak trees. Also, if you've had a lot of hail, worry a little bit about fire blight on fruit trees like apples and crab apples and pears. Hail can injure the branches, and that can provide an entry point for the bacterium that causes that particular disease. But that's not the only way that one will get in. It's actually moved around most commonly by honeybees. They drop it off in the flowers as they pollinate. So a couple of diseases that you might worry about.
Yeah, and you know, you've got a fractured limb on an oak. Maybe just talk for a second about how to remove those broken limbs. They should be removed if at all possible, I would think.
Yeah, the unfortunate part is oftentimes by the time you get to removing those branches, it may be too late in terms of transmission for oak wilt, because some of the research indicates that sap beetles can visit a wounded tree within 10 minutes of the wound forming. So, but if you can get out, make a clean cut, and then on an oak tree, if you need to do any cutting during the growing season, immediately paint over that wound. And I mean immediately, have a can of paint sitting next to you as you make the cut, and then paint over it. That'll deter the insects from visiting.
How's Lisa, to you for a minute, how's the rain affected our you know, flowering and vegetable plants?
Well, it's been kind of interesting. Some things are just growing gangbusters, and others are struggling a little bit. It's really partly dependent on your soil. If you have very heavy soil and we've been getting all this rain, your plants might be struggling because they're not getting enough oxygen to the roots and potentially getting one of Brian's lovely root rot diseases. But a lot of plants are doing, you know, okay or really well.
Tell you what, my potted plants, which I've got quite a few pots around the, you know, the yard in this place or that, I haven't had to do a whole lot of watering of those plants. That's been one saver of labor for me.
Absolutely.
Oh, gosh. Apple scab. Brian, I hear you've been seeing a lot of apple scab.
Yeah, I've been in the clinic. It'll be 26 years this coming Monday, and I've never seen a year as good for apple scab as this year, or bad, depending upon your point of view. From a plant pathologist's point of view, a good year for apple scab. It's just been everywhere. We had rains at exactly the right time. So we had rains right as the trees were leafing out, which is the primary time for the first infections to occur in the leaves. The spores for that come out of leaf litter on the ground. And then once those initial infections occur, then the fungus produces additional spores on the leaf surface that can get spread around. And because of all the rains we've had on a regular basis, it's just been great weather for those additional infections to occur. So if you've got a crab apple tree, or an apple tree that's defoliating, it's most likely from apple scab. And even the resistant varieties, I'm seeing some apple scab even on those varieties as well.
What does it look like aside from the leaves falling?
Initially, what you'll tend to see is kind of a blotchy, grayish black sort of discoloration to the leaves. Oftentimes, it'll kind of be along the midrib or mid vein of the leaf. And then the leaves can eventually kind of start to turn yellow. But again, the disease is progressing quite rapidly. So you may not see that yellowing phase, but then all of a sudden the leaves will dry up, turn brown, and then fall off.
And not much to do about it, or?
Not at this point. The unfortunate part is if you have a susceptible tree, one of the options you have for control and really about the only option you have to prevent the disease would be fungicide treatments. And because of the rains, exactly when we got those rains, that's when you needed to be applying the fungicides, and people couldn't do that. So we've had people, I've had commercial arborists who have contacted me and said, you know, we've been treating clients' trees and they're still getting apple scab, and it's all a matter of timing. If you don't get those initial applications on right as the trees are leafing out, you basically are done for the season because the fungus gets established, and then subsequent treatments really don't do a lot of good.
Phyllis in the town of Dunn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Phyllis.
Thank you. So I have a backyard orchard, and right now just about everything's dead in it, and at least one tree had fire blight. I'm not sure what the others had, but I've been told to burn it, but I'd like to plant new trees, but it's, that's a lot of wood to burn, and I know that's polluting the air and so on. So I wonder, could I bury it instead, or is there anything I can do?
Yeah, I'd make sure first that your trees are actually dead. With apple scab, the trees look dead because they defoliate, but they're not really dead. They have buds set for next year, and they will leaf out next year. And lots of trees that get lots of apple scab actually bloom quite profusely, even though they've lost their leaves during a given growing season. With fire blight, I would prune out the dead branches. If you know for sure that you have fire blight, you'll see the tips of the branches die back. Usually the infection points will start around where the blossoms were attached again because the bees bring in the bacterium. But if you can kind of distinguish between where the live and dead portion of the branch is, you can go down about 12 inches below that interface and prune that. You don't have to take out the entire tree, quite frankly. Although if the bacterium that causes that disease gets into the main trunk, then you will have to remove the tree. But as you mentioned, burning, if you've got a lot of trees, that can be quite a job to do that. You can bury the material if you would prefer to do that. That's another option, for particularly for fire blight. But again, make sure your trees are actually dead. They may not be.
Yeah, there you go, Phyllis. Thank you so much for calling. Annette in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Annette.
Boy, that was quick. Yeah, Brian, I've asked you about this before, peach leaf curl. And
yeah.
We have put on the dormant oil in the spring, but it's come back several times. And I don't know, should we cull all, there's a handful of peaches on there, should we cull them and pick off the leaves, or what? Is there hope? The tree?
Yeah. Dormant oil is not really effective for peach leaf curl. Dormant oil works better against insect pests. So as a treatment, I would suggest a copper-containing material that's labeled for use on fruit trees, and that can be applied either in the fall after the trees have dropped their leaves, or in the spring before they bud out. Or if you've had really serious problems, you could potentially apply it both times of the year. Usually one treatment will be perfectly fine, but the dormant oils really won't take care of the peach leaf curl fungus. It needs to be something like copper. That works a lot better. And copper is a pretty good material to use. It can have some toxicity issues if you apply it on leaves, depending upon environmental conditions. But at the time you would be applying this just to the branches, the temperatures are going to be relatively cool. So it should be really effective and should control the disease. And if for folks who don't know what peach leaf curl, if you've got a peach tree and all of a sudden the leaves start to get kind of puckered, and instead of being green, they be maybe light, kind of creamy colored or bright pink, and very, very kind of curled and bubbly looking. That's peach leaf curl. It's a fungal disease. And then if you happen to grow plums, there's a variation on the disease on plums called plum pockets, where the fruits get infected and they get really big and hollow. And initially they'll be quite spongy, and then they'll get kind of dried out and brittle at the end. But yeah, you can control peach leaf curl if you use the right product and do it, the application at the right time.
Annette, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Lisa, we got an email from Samantha in Whitehall who asks about advice for non-chemical ways to keep deer from eating her vegetables.
Oh, okay. I mean, ideally you'd have a deer fence, but that's pretty expensive to do because it needs to be at least 8 feet high, or you can use what's called a double fence method. We do have a publication at the Learning Store on deer and managing deer damage. We also have a publication on plants that are not attractive to deer. And, you know, you can't necessarily apply that to every deer, but as a general group, there are plants that are not attractive to deer. So most vegetables, unfortunately, are. There are some repellent products out there that are pretty good, but you also can use different techniques. Now, deer will get used to different deterrents that you might put out. One of the things that's sometimes recommended is Mylar ribbon along kind of a clothesline, and as it kind of blows around in the wind, it's supposed to detract them or keep them away. Another thing that is sometimes used, and we have this at the Teaching Garden, there's a product called Predator Guard, and it has a couple, it's a solar, a little solar array that has two red lights that are supposed to look like predator eyes. Now you have to move that around the garden, but that has worked somewhat as well for us. But definitely the repellent products, I think, can do a good job.
Do those electric, you know, there's electric fencing, you know, where you could have a line and there's sort of a solar battery kind of operated deal, I believe, for it. Have those been effective at all with deer?
You know, I don't have a lot of familiarity with that particular type of product. Good question for David Drake, though.
I'll have to ask David the next time he's on the show for sure, or maybe Scott if he's on the show. Well, you can join in to 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Lisa, a viburnum leaf beetle has been busy this year. What does it look like, and what can we do about it?
It about every other contact that I got in April, May, and early June were pictures of people's viburnums that were looking like Japanese beetle attack. I mean, lacy, eaten down to the margins, or not the margins, but the midrib, just really bad. In Dane County, Actually, P.J. Leash, our entomologist, identified it in Middleton a few years ago, and it has spread to a lot of parts of Dane County. Unfortunately, almost all of our viburnums are susceptible to it. They don't appear to like the fuzzy-leafed ones as well, but they still will go after them. So for me, as a horticulturist, I pretty much have to take viburnum off the table as a recommended plant species, because between the borer and the leaf beetle, we're just really in a bad place. So what you can do if you haven't had a major attack is you can, this fall, look at the ends of the branch tips, and you will find where the female beetle has laid eggs for next year. So those look like little raised areas. What she does is she digs out a little shallow pit, puts in the eggs, and uses her saliva and the wood that she dug out of the pit to cover the egg. So it looks like this little brown raised thing. Usually in a row, you'll see several of them in a row. If you prune those out during the dormant season, the larva won't hatch because they won't be there. So that's a really nice organic way. But if you've got more than like one shrub, yeah, it becomes an issue.
A lot of work.
So we've got a very, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
We've got a very nice fact sheet at the Wisconsin Horticulture site, also on PJ's Insect Diagnostic Lab site, that gives you some other things that you can do. If you happen to catch this when the larvae are out, you can use spinosad. I think we're pretty much done for the year. I haven't seen any of the adult beetles or any further damage. And this is unfortunately one of those insects that while the larva does the most damage, the adults can do damage too. So you kind of get this 1-2 punch that's not very nice for the plant.
Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests today from the University of Wisconsin and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk with our guest Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW as well. Lots of callers online. Let's go to Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota. Hi, Pam. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I call you two the dynamic duo. I love it when you two are on. In April, I had a neighbor think it was a good idea to light his pampas grass on fire. And it was a 50-mile-an-hour wind day that day. So I have DNR land in between me, and it burnt very quickly right to my 20 acres. And I have been planting trees for 48 years. The smaller ones, you could tell, were dead immediately. The medium... the ones, they stopped it right before my house. The ones that were 30 years old, it looked like half would be dead. The heat damage killed half of the side, and the other side looked like it might survive. Well, now 3 months later, they are getting new needles on them. The ones out the road that were very badly burnt around the whole perimeter, you know, that I know this is just going to be a guessing game because I have wondered what's going to happen during this period. I'm wondering if the ones that out the road that were so damaged around the base might just be putting their last effort into staying alive this year, and maybe they won't come back next year. And I know it's just a guessing game, but I'd like someone that had a better guess than me.
Pam, I think you should get the neighbor to hire a tree doctor to come over and take a look, but at your neighbor's expense, for sure. But what have you guys got for it? Lisa, anything, or Brian?
So you're right. First of all, my sympathies. That's terrible. And I hope that you got some insurance payments out of that or something to replace your trees. So you're right that it is a guessing game. It's difficult to tell sometimes when a tree has had enough vascular damage that it is lethal. And you're right that sometimes they will leaf out, or in this case, needle out. But then they have so much vascular damage that they perish over the winter. Now, we've had so much rain this year that they haven't been under water stress with a compromised vascular system. So it would be more difficult to tell than last year, for example, when everything was water stressed. Because when the vascular system is compromised and the plant can't pull up water and the soil is dry to begin with, then you know, you see those kinds of effects much more quickly than when we have saturated soils. So I guess that would be my input is, you're right, it's wait and see. I don't know whether Brian has any further to add.
Really add much more than that. It's just really unfortunate, and you're just going to have to see which plants survive the winter and which ones don't.
The ones with thicker bark, like if you have oaks, you know, oak savannas were, those oaks are evolutionarily prepared to deal with fire. They have a very thick, corky bark. But, you know, other plants that have less thick bark, and if the bark was badly burned, then yeah, it's likely that the heat would have destroyed the vascular system because it's right underneath the bark.
Yeah.
So if your bark is thin in the first place, that's a problem.
Yeah. Pam, I'm sorry for those problems, but I appreciate your call very much. Ron and Amory will give you a chance. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. We've got a really old orchard. It was probably six trees, and then we have a plum tree and a crab apples, and they've produced an amazing amount of apples each year. But they tend to have some wormholes and other things, and I really didn't want to put a nasty chemical on them. But I'm wondering what's recommended, and am I too late for this year to put a treatment on them?
For insect or for disease?
Insect.
Okay. Yes and no. It depends on the type of insect that you're getting. What you might want to do is put up some red sticky balls to see if you catch any apple maggots. Apple maggots are, the adults are a fly, and the larvae are the problem in the apple as a pest. We also have coddling moth, though, which is kind of the same, where we have an adult moth that is laying eggs on the fruit, and then we have the problems with the larva. And then our last of the big three bad actors is plum curculio, and they do start laying eggs in small fruit. Usually it's kind of a crescent-shaped wound. And unfortunately, the adult weevil also will stick its snout in there and make big holes as it feeds. So that one starts earlier than the other two. But you might still be able to save some of your harvest. Now, there are a couple of things that you can do that are non-chemical. Since you only have six trees, if they're smaller trees, you can bag your apples, and we do have a nice fact sheet on that at the Wisconsin Horticulture site. You can also use kale and clay, which is an organic treatment, does make your trees look like they're made of cement, but it can help to keep off the various insect pests. It confuses them. Now, you do have to wash your apple fruits off pretty well to get the kale and clay off. Now, kale and clay is used in a lot of different things, some toothpastes and other edible products. So you know, you don't have the toxicity worries that you might with other things. However, I am assuming that a number of your fruits are already infested. What you might want to do if you want to try the bagging is look for apples that look sound, that don't look lumpy, that don't have any holes in them, and protect them for the rest of the season. If when you scan your trees, you see that a whole lot of them are already lumpy or have holes, then it's probably not going to do you any good to do the spray at this time. But you might want to do the monitoring, because that will tell you in the future when you need to do treatments. Another great guide for treatments is what used to be called the Wisconsin Pest Bulletin. It's now called Field Notes from DatCap. So if you look online, you can sign up for that. And there are a bunch of orchardists that participate in that, and they give you counts of the different insects that they've caught with their black lights or other things. And that kind of gives you a sense of when the insects are in your area and you might need to start sprays. Now, there are certainly a lot of different types of insecticides that can be used. Some are, you know, reduced risk, others not so much. And I know we don't have time to go into all of those. So what you might want to do is, we have a publication on fruit tree pests, and I know it's at the Learning Store. It might be at the Wisconsin Horticulture site as well. That gives some more information about that.
So, and UW Learning Store, I guess you put that in a search engine, it should pop up.
Yeah, or put in Wisconsin horticulture. And it's just, I'm not sure that that particular publication has been moved to the Wisconsin horticulture site.
Okay, Ron, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Susan.
Good morning. Thank you, Larry. I have a two-year-old apple tree. It's about 4 foot tall, and it just started getting small yellow spots with a black dot in the center of the spot. What have I got?
Yeah, that's most likely a disease, a fungal disease called cedar apple rust. Rust diseases are fungal in nature. This particular fungus spends part of its life cycle on your apple leaves and the rest of its life cycle on junipers. Particularly if you happen to have any red cedar nearby, that's a type of juniper, and that's a really great host for this particular fungus. What you can look for earlier in the growing season on the junipers are, you could look right now for little brown blobs that look like little tiny brains attached to the branches. That's actually a gall that's induced by the presence of the fungus. And then earlier in the spring, those will sprout these large gelatinous orange masses or arms that produce spores that drift over onto your apple trees and infect. And you'll get these little yellow spots. The black in the center is a little fruiting body, a little reproductive structure. Another one, these fungi produce lots of reproductive structures. Eventually, if you watch those yellow spots on the undersurface of the leaf, you're going to see some little spikes or tendrils that will form, and those produce spores that drift back over onto the junipers. For the most part, cedar apple rust tends to be a somewhat cosmetic disease. Occasionally, you will get infections on the fruits, but most of the time, I see primarily these little yellow spots on the leaves, and they can get larger as we get farther into the growing season. They can get up to about the size of diameter of a dime or so. Typically, we don't see a lot of defoliation or leaf loss with this disease, although on occasion, and this has been an extreme year, in really extreme years, I have seen some leaf loss, but you may just see these little spots and that'll be the end of it. What I normally tell folks to do is look for the junipers that are near your trees and either get rid of them or watch for those little galls and prune those out. And if you can do that and get your junipers and your apple trees physically separated by a large enough distance, then that typically takes care of the disease. It's when those two plants are really close to one another where you're going to have a severe case of the disease. So I would not recommend treating for this disease with chemical control. It takes a whole bunch of treatments on your apple tree, and they have to be fairly specifically timed properly. So it's usually not something that home gardeners are able to accommodate. So I think, again, just looking for those junipers, either getting rid of them or pruning out the galls is the best way to go for management.
Susan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's move to Karen in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a question about my fruit trees during that storm. And I had cherry and plum trees that were split in half. I don't know if it was lightning or if it was just the wind. But I had somebody come and clean up the trees and, you know, take a chainsaw and cut the limbs off that were damaged. But then, like the cherry tree, one of the limbs kind of came back up towards the main trunk, but there's still like a hole, I guess, if you will, in there. And somebody said something about painting it earlier in the show. Can you tell me? And also the trees, these plum and these apple, I lost an apple, a plum, and half a cherry. I have mold around the bottom of the trunk. Could you address that too, please?
Okay. Yeah, we normally don't recommend painting wounds on trees other than on oaks when you have to prune those during the growing season. There's some research that indicates that applying these sorts of paints to, in many situations, actually slows down natural production of tissue that will close over those wounds. So we usually steer people away from painting other than, again, on oak trees. And that's to deter the insects that bring in the oak wilt fungus. I wouldn't necessarily do that. The main thing is to try to keep those areas as dry as possible, which has been really, really difficult given our weather pattern. So my concern with the cherry tree, where part of it's gone, but you're trying to maintain the other part of the tree, is that it may be wet enough that you will get introduction of wood rot fungi, and those will cause additional damage to the tree. So you may see that. You may see little what are called shelf fungi, fungal conchs that will form on that wounded area, and that's not necessarily a good thing. Just be prepared that cherry may not survive very much longer. In terms of the fungal growth that you may be seeing around the base of the tree, it's hard to tell based just on that description. The best thing you might be able to do, if you're interested, would be to take some digital photos and send those through my clinic website, and I can take a look at it and see if I can figure out what it is. If I can, I do charge for that. It helps support our clinic. But if I can't, there's no charge. But there are a variety of things. It could be, some could be serious, others not. But unfortunately, I can't really say. The one thing that you might be dealing with, particularly if you've applied new mulch around the trees, there are organisms called slime mold. And the one that we oftentimes see is, we affectionately call dog vomit slime mold, because it looks like somebody's dog has kind of upchucked on your mulch, and you'll get this mass of kind of foamy material that will form. And those organisms are actually mobile, so they can kind of crawl around and they'll grow up the base of trees on occasion. I've seen them do that, but they're innocuous. They will eventually disappear. And we've had a lot of wet weather, so I would expect to see a lot of those. Another name for that one is scrambled eggs, slime mold, because they kind of look like scrambled eggs as well. So, but I like dog vomit. I think that is more appealing to me. But if you prefer scrambled egg, you can do that. But again, I'd have to see some photos in order to really provide more information on that.
And if you dial in the PDD, Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic,
UW Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, that should get you to my website. And right on the main page at the top, there's a little boxed in area, which will have a link to our digital diagnosis submission form. And again, it's a $20 fee to do a digital diagnosis, if I can tell you something intelligent about what might be going on with your trees or other plants. And if not, we don't charge. I might suggest you send in a physical sample, and we charge a fee for that as well. But we'll help you out as much as we possibly can.
Karen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Marcella emailed that her maple tree seems to have some kind of disease. The west side of the trunk is quite black. The bark is peeling off, and the leaves are drying up and falling. Is there anything she can do to help?
The peeling of the bark and the blackening, they may be interrelated. If you're seeing bark coming off and you're seeing it all the way down to the wood, that could be something called a frost crack. And those oftentimes form on maple trees. Maples are particularly prone to those. They're all oftentimes an indication that the tree is under some sort of stress. And probably the most common stress that I see on a lot of trees is that when they were originally planted, they were planted too deeply. And if you look at the trunk of that tree and it comes down looking like a telephone pole as it goes into the soil, that's an indication that it was planted too deeply. Optimally, if it's been planted at the right height, that trunk will widen out to form what's called the root flare. And you should be able to see that just above the soil line if it's been planted at the right depth. Trees that are under stress and are planted too deeply, they oftentimes can develop what are called girdling roots. These are roots that instead of growing outward from the trunk, grow around the trunk. And then as the trunk gets bigger and bigger, as the tree ages, it will come into contact with those roots. And that compresses the water conducting tissue under the bark. And that'll prevent water from getting up to the upper part of the trees. And that'll also put stress on the bark of the trunk so that in the wintertime, as the bark goes through cycles of heating and cooling, that'll stress the bark enough that it will split. And oftentimes that bark will loosen and will peel away. And the black that you're seeing is probably what are called sooty molds. These are kind of environmental fungi. They're just kind of out there. They're not disease-causing organisms, but they will tend to grow on surfaces where there's an extraneous food source. And when you get these splits in the trunk, you'll have some sap leakage onto the bark, and that can provide the food that these fungi will grow on. And when you have that split, anything that is kind of connected via the water conducting tissue in that area where the bark is disturbed, those branches are not going to get enough water, and that can lead to branch dieback, leaf browning and drop, those sorts of symptoms as well. So unfortunately, there's not much you can do about those frost cracks. It's an issue that was set up at the time that the tree was planted. But anything you can do during dry periods, again, I'm going to talk about applying water, but we really don't need that right now. We've been getting plenty of rain, but if we would get into a droughty period, then maybe applying some supplemental water to the tree to try to keep it growing as vigorously as possible. But again, if you've got girdling roots, there's not a lot you can do about those, unfortunately.
Yep. Thanks for that question. Brian Huddleston, Lisa Johnson, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests today, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. Great to have them with us. And I hope you can join in with your questions and comments. I wanted a quick thanks to everybody who donated during our June member drive. Lots of people. Casey and Weston was one of them. Rasma and Fond du Lac, Julianne and Menasha. Lots of people helped make WPR possible. And if you missed joining in, there's still time. You can go to WPR.org/donate. And when you ask, you know there's a WPR bucket hat for $20 a month or your WPR cap mug for $30 a month, you can help play an important role in keeping WPR going and Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. Say thank you for your partnership. And again, you can go to WPR.org/donate. Mark emailed that he'd like to know how he can tell if a defoliated branch is dead or not dead.
Yeah, I would just carefully in a little area scrape back the bark and see whether it looks green underneath. And if it does, then that branch is still alive. And again, if you've got apple trees that have lost their leaves right now, they're likely still fine. again, the main disease we've been seeing on apples and crab apples is apple scab this year, and that's not a lethal disease. So,
yeah.
The other thing to look for with dead branches is if the bark looks kind of wrinkly, that is often a sign that is dead. The other thing is sometimes there's kind of an off color to the twigs on those branches. But Brian's right. The scratch test is the thing to do.
Yeah, simple and quick and easy. Ricardo in Rolling Ground, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi. I've been growing apples for quite some time without chemicals. And the strategy I used for scab, which according to what I'm hearing from you is pretty successful this year, is getting the spore load out of the orchard or out from underneath the trees in the fall. I put the bagger on mowing or riding mower, and I mow up those leaves and get them quite a distance away. And I really do not have a heck of a lot of scab this year. It could be that the rains here are a different profile than what's happening elsewhere, but seems to work for me. Probably going to do 2, maybe 3 mowings, which is a little energy intensive, but it works. And mowing short, like in riding mower, also gets rid of the stuff that mice live in, so you have fewer deer ticks around.
Yeah, all good points.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely recommend good cleanup of leaf debris, no matter what the tree, quite frankly, if you've had any disease problems, because it's in that leaf litter, that's where the pathogens are going to survive the winter. And unfortunately, with apple scab, that's a great thing to do. Sometimes it can be not totally successful because it doesn't take a lot of leaves that you've missed harboring the fungus to really lead to an epidemic, because that fungus can produce a lot of spores. And once those initial infections occur out of that leaf litter, then the fungus also just produces a ton of spores on the leaves, on the new leaves on the tree. So definitely, I think it's great that you're getting rid of those leaves. That's an excellent thing to do. The other thing I would do for management of apple scab that's non-chemical would be routine pruning of the tree to thin the canopy. That tends to allow better airflow. That will tend to dry out the leaves more quickly when they get wet. And the drier you can keep the leaves, the less likely these sorts of fungal pathogens are going to be able to infect. But unfortunately, this year we've just had so much rain that it doesn't make any difference how well you pruned. Your leaves are going to be wet.
And there are some resistant apple varieties out there, but as Brian always says, resistance does not mean immunity. And when you have a huge spore load like we have this year, even that might not help. But if you want to check out some of those, we have Enterprise in our little mini orchard at the Teaching Garden. And I haven't seen any scab. I've seen some cedar apple rust, but you can find some of those disease-resistant cultivars in the publication. Let's see here. It's fruit cultivars or home fruit cultivars for southern Wisconsin. They haven't updated the northern one, but many of the apple varieties still will do just fine in northern Wisconsin. So there's a whole list in that publication of newer as well as older resistant varieties.
And Ricardo, Lisa mentioned rust, and did you have a question about apple rust?
Yeah, the cedar apple rust, which seems pretty bad this year, right? I didn't know that junipers were a worse carrier than the cedars. Are white cedars implicated in this? And also, are there other fruits and apple that are affected by?
Yeah. White cedar is Thuja. That's the scientific name. So that's totally different from true junipers, which are juniperous. And it's unfortunate that we call red cedar because it's not a true cedar. It's actually a type of juniper. But that's, if you have red cedar, that's the one really to get rid of, because it harbors all of the really common rusts that we see on our fruit crops. These are generically called gymnosporangium rust. So cedar apple rust, there's also a cedar hawthorn rust, which tends to occur more on hawthorn leaves. And then we also have cedar quince rust is the other really common one. And that one, we don't grow a lot of quince here in the state. There is a little bit of it. But where I see cedar quince rust, quite frankly, is on hawthorn fruit. If you ever go out to your hawthorn trees and you see these kind of spiny, salmony colored fruits on your hawthorns, that's another one of these rusts that alternates with junipers. And then we have a new one, actually, that's just been discovered in the state a couple of years ago called red star rust. So if you're looking at your apples or your crab apples, instead of seeing little yellow or orange spots on the leaves, you start to see really bright red or fuchsia color spots. That could be this new rust. And if you happen to see that, please contact me. Again, if you go onto my clinic website, my contact information is there. You can send me a photo of that. If you see those red spots in your apples or crab apple leaves, we don't charge for that diagnosis because we're trying to map that disease in the state. And you can send me a photo, say, I think I have red star rust. We'll tell you whether or not you do. And if you don't, I'll give you a free diagnosis of what the disease is. And if you're from a county where we have not officially documented red star rust, we will ask you to send in a set of leaves with the symptoms. And we'll do additional testing and try to confirm. Again, we're trying to figure out exactly where that is in the state. I think it's pretty widespread. I think it's been here for quite a while. We just haven't recognized it as a different disease from some of these other gymnosporangium rusts that we've had in the state for decades.
Hmm.
Management is still the same,
though. It's basically the same. The unfortunate part is for the other common gymnosporangium rusts, so cedar apple rust, cedar hawthorn rust, cedar quince rust, I talked about getting rid of junipers. An alternative for those rusts is to plant resistant junipers. And the one that we have typically recommended has been Chinese juniper. Unfortunately, Chinese juniper is the preferred alternate host for this red star rust. So we've been kind of setting ourselves up to have this disease be more prevalent. So
there you go, Ricardo. I hope that helps.
I had one more comment.
Go ahead. We've just got about a minute. Go ahead.
My biggest recommendation for anybody who wants to do fruit growing without a lot of chemicals is to get a hold of the book called The Apple Grower by Michael Phillips. It changed my practice immediately. It's a great book.
That is a good book.
The Apple Grower by Michael Phillips. Thank you very much, Ricardo. Appreciate your call. Well, we're covering a lot of ground here, and we still have a lot more ground to cover with our guests, and they'll be with us up until 12:30 today on the show. Lisa Johnson is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Brian Hoddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. He resides in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. It's always great to have them stop by and be with us. And you'll be able to join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson. Always great to have them come by to answer your gardening questions. They'll be with us till 12:30, but stay with us because there's more Garden Talk coming up at 12:30. We'll talk with roses with an expert from UW River Falls. But now let's go to the phones again, and Diana in Lake Geneva has a question. So let's go there. Diana, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. This is Diane from Lake Geneva, and I have had trouble for several years with what I think might be red spider mites that are on my ox-eye sunflowers, the fall sunflowers that are really great for the pollinators. They bloom, but on the stems, before the blooms even open, the stems become covered with these miniature little red bugs. And I've tried soapy water. I've tried, I haven't used any herbicides on them. I've talked to our local Pesci's Garden Center. They don't seem to be able to help me. And I'm just wondering if someone there might have an idea what I'm dealing with. I've moved them at a different location. They find it. So
okay.
I don't know what it is.
Well, Lisa, have you got a crack at it?
Yes. I think you may be dealing with a species of aphid. I have often seen a lot of our native plants get large concentrations, large populations of an orange-red colored aphid. I'm thinking the spider mites are usually going to be underneath the leaves and cause damage that looks like speckling. So usually you're not going to see them clustered around stems or flower buds. We have found, and I know I have a resource about this somewhere, that those aphids actually don't seem to do a whole lot of damage for the most part to the plant. Now, you're saying, though, that you're experiencing having the flower buds turn black. Is that correct?
No, the flower buds do not seem to turn black, but if I should want to cut them to take to a friend and share with them, they don't look very nice with all of this sticky substance, and evidently they must secrete something because I have some lilies that are next to them, and the lily leaves are all glossy. So they must have some sort of a substance on them that spreads to the next the next areas. So just wondering what to do with them, but it doesn't look very enticing.
Because unsightly, let's put it that way.
Yeah. So what's happening is that the aphids are sucking insects, and in order to fulfill their nutritional needs, they have to suck a whole lot of plant sap. And that sap has to go somewhere, so they excrete that, and it tends to have a lot of sugar in it. So what they're excreting is something called honeydew, and the honeydew will fall on whatever happens to be around. If you have, for example, scales like magnolia scales, on trees, you will often find that there is a ton of honeydew on the ground, and it's often colonized by a fungus that is not particularly pathogenic, but called sooty mold. And now that's definitely not very aesthetically pleasing to look at. What I would try doing is I would try rinsing them. I mean, if you're giving cut flowers to a friend, I would try rinsing those aphids off. If you feel that you really can't deal with having aphids on the plant, what you've been doing, the insecticidal soap is a good recommendation. Spinosad may work as well. Neem oil is another possibility. Since aphids have a soft body, they are much more susceptible to insecticides than insects with harder sorts of shells. And you can also try spraying them off with a hard spray of water. But yeah, those are kind of endemic to our area, and usually they don't cause a lot of damage. And I'll look for that reference, Larry, and if you want to put it up later.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Diane, thank you very much for calling. Lynn emailed, she has a mature sour cherry tree. It bloomed this spring, but the fruit failed to set and it has not leafed out post-blossom. Is it dead?
That sounds like it probably is dead. You could certainly leave it until the following spring to see whether it does leaf out. But if you haven't had any leaf out this far into the season, my guess is that that tree has not survived. So that's unfortunate. Sometimes they'll have enough, as Lisa was talking about before, sometimes they'll have enough oomph in them to push out things like flower buds. But if they have, if their vascular tissue, their water conducting tissue has been damaged in some way, then they oftentimes will not do much more than that. One of the things I would watch for, because I've seen a lot of this on cherries and plums, any of the stone fruits, would be watch those areas that have not leafed out the branches and see if you see any blobs of sap that are being produced on those branches. And if you do, then you're dealing with a bacterial disease called bacterial canker, and that can be severe enough that it will cause branch dieback. And if the bacterium gets into the main trunk, it can girdle the main trunk and totally kill the tree. And like I said, I've seen a lot of that particular disease this year, this spring, on cherries, plums, peaches, anything that's, like I said, is a stone fruit.
Darlene in Mount Horeb, it's your turn. Hi, Darlene.
Good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call. The question, can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, okay. Darlene. Go ahead, yeah.
Okay, I must be getting feedback on my phone. I have two questions about our trees. We planted a new serviceberry just a few weeks ago, and there appear to be some spots on some of the leaves. They're kind of yellow, brownish. Some of them look like they're like the inside is brown with a yellow halo around the outside. The second question relates to a big old black walnut we have. It's probably at least 60 feet tall, and it seems to be dropping leaves really early this year. You know, they typically do start early in the fall, but in June already we noticed a lot of leaves coming down from the walnut, and wondered if any or all of this is just related to the wet weather we've been having.
Yeah, in a way, both of them are. The yellowing that you're seeing on your serviceberry, that could be, we talked about gymnosporangium rust earlier, so cedar apple rust, those sorts of rust. Those sorts of diseases can go to serviceberry as well. And I actually had some photos come into my lab that showed these kind of yellowish spots on serviceberry leaves, and there was some browning in association with those. The other thing to watch for would be if you have any fruits on the tree, if they're kind of spiny looking, then again, that would be an indication that you're dealing with one of these rust diseases. In terms of your walnuts losing leaves, again, there are a variety of different fungi that cause what are called anthracnose diseases. Commonly see these on maples, ash trees, where you'll get kind of brown, blotchy areas. Walnuts can also get these same sorts of diseases, just slightly different fungi. And depending upon where the infection occurs, if it occurs on the little stems on the leaves, that can cause the leaves to drop. So that's probably what you're dealing with. The main thing for both of these disease, well, particularly the walnut disease, is good cleanup of the leaf litter around the tree in the fall, just to remove that and get rid of that as a source of the fungus that could potentially infect your trees next year. Again, if what you're seeing on your serviceberry is one of these gymnosporangium rusts, then you have some junipers somewhere close that are providing the spores that are infecting your service berries. So getting rid of those junipers, or again, looking for the galls, the little growths, and pruning those out, that's going to be beneficial in terms of managing that disease. And again, if we see a drier growing season, even one not as dry maybe as last year, but less rain than what we've been seeing this year, you may not see severe cases of these sorts of diseases in the future until we get another really rainy season.
Darlene, does that help out?
Yes, yes, does very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for calling. Anthracnose came up there in that conversation, and Suzanne had asked about anthracnose in an oak tree, what symptoms mm-hmm. might present an oak, and how, what's a treatment for an oak tree?
Learn to ignore it is the best treatment for anthracnose on things like oaks and maples. It's typically a cosmetic disease, and we don't see a lot of significant damage. And in fact, oaks can get quite severe anthracnose to the point where they will drop their leaves early in the growing season, and then they will put out a second set of leaves. And oftentimes by mid-season, you'd never know that they had an anthracnose problem earlier on. But the typical symptoms for anthracnose are kind of blotchy, brown slash dead areas on the leaves. That's a typical symptom no matter what tree or shrub you're dealing with for an anthracnose problem. So the other thing I have seen though on oaks this year, we talked about peach leaf curl earlier, and there's actually a variant of that particular fungus that will infect oak leaves, causes oak leaf blister. So if you get kind of bubbly areas on your oak leaves, they look like kind of a little bit of a raised mound where the tissue is kind of bubbling up. You could be dealing with that disease as well. Again, that's very cosmetic. Oaks and most forest trees are quite well adapted to having leaf diseases and just kind of overcoming them long-term. So I wouldn't worry too much about those.
Anne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi, I have a question. We have a Montmorency cherry tree, and it looked like it was doing just great. The cherries were sort of a red-orange color, and then they started to deepen red. And I went out to pick them, and they all have these like dark brown spots on them, and they appear to be rotting. I don't know what happened, but we waited till they were ripe enough to pick, and then now they're rotten.
Yeah.
Do they look kind of fuzzy and kind of buff colored by any chance?
Not.
Were you
not
seeing
really.
The rotted areas?
Yeah, okay. I mean they just look kind of like bruised fruit. They look like they're overripe okay. or bruised.
Yeah. You could be dealing with a disease called brown rot. It's quite common, again, on stone fruits in general, and that would include cherries. And it's a fungal disease, again, because of the wet weather. It would be a great year to see a lot of this. But typically with that disease, eventually what you'll see on the fruits is this kind of buff-colored, fuzzy sporulation that will occur on the surface of the fruits. That might be what you're dealing with. It could be some other sort of fungal infection as well. And at least I don't know if there are any insects that might cause that sort of rotted look to cherry fruits.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if it might be an insect where they laid an egg. You know, if it's just a very small hole, you might not notice it, but it is possible that it could be some sort of insect problem.
Yeah, you could cut open some of those fruits and see if there's anything crawling around inside them, and that might give you some additional information about what might be going on.
Yeah, good points. Anne, thank you for calling. Bill in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. I have a maple tree in my front yard. Trunk is about 8 inches in diameter, so not a huge maple tree. Over the last few years, there have been a lot of kind of dead branches up near the top of the tree. And just this summer, I've noticed some kind of hard black bullet-shaped fungus growing out of the base of the trunk. So I'm wondering, is there anything I can do to save the tree, or does it need to be cut down? So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, those fungi that you're seeing, how big are they? And
oh,
are
gosh,
they a little I cluster?
Think, yeah, yes, a cluster.
And kind of
and
darkish?
Say, yeah, dark, very hard.
Darking?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm wondering if what you're dealing with is a fungus called dead man's fingers. I don't see that very often on maple trees. I can't say, but I've been seeing it on some odd trees this year. I oftentimes see it associated with fruit trees, but it's a bona fide pathogen. So it's a root rot organism. It causes a disease called black root rot. And it tends to be somewhat opportunistic. It tends to be more inclined to infect trees that are under a lot of stress. And given the droughty conditions we had last year, that would definitely qualify many trees as being stressed. So I think that's what you may be dealing with. If you're interested, if you go to my clinic website, again, that's if you just do a search on UW-Madison Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, you'll pop up my website and then go into the fact sheet section. There'll be a menu across the top of the main page. Select fact sheets and then look up the one called Dead Man's Fingers and see if that looks like what you're dealing with. Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about that particular fungus if it gets established in a tree other than kind of try to keep the tree from going under additional stress. Make sure it's getting plenty of water if we get into a droughty period. Eventually, that will cause the tree to decline, and you're going to have to think about replacing that tree, unfortunately.
Yeah, there you go, Bill. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Sue in Vilas County emailed, and this goes to the lady whose trees suffered fire damage. She believes every county in Wisconsin has a county forester. I think she's right about that. She had one come out, a forester come out and assess some tree issues. They're trained to recognize the degree of damage, like the fire in the trees, and it's free. So the county forester may be of help in this particular situation. And Bill emailed, he has a Honeycrisp apple tree. Didn't bloom this year. The tree appears to be healthy, but some of the leaves have small bites taken out of them. Last year he had very few bees, wondered if it never got pollinated. The tree's about 20 years old and has never happened before. It wasn't trimmed last year. Any idea what could be the problem?
So did the tree bloom and just didn't set fruit?
It did not bloom this year at all.
It did not bloom.
Okay.
Otherwise, seems healthy.
I'm wondering if it's an alternate year bearer by chance, and maybe the stress of last year didn't set many flower buds. I would be surprised if there weren't any, though. So there may be something else going on with that.
Yeah. The other possibility would be if there was a frost around the time when the flower buds were first coming out, then they could have gotten frosted off as well, and you might never have seen them.
Yeah, that's another good point. Joan in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I have a problem with my phlox. I looked up what I thought would be appropriate, and it looks like they have leaf curl. Not sure what to do about that. And it's growing a little bit. It's spreading to some of my other flocks. So that's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, leaf curl is kind of a symptom rather than... And a lot of things can cause leaf curl. One of the things I'm thinking aphids again, Lisa. You might want to comment on that.
Or spider mites. I often see spider mites on flocks. Of course, this is not a great year for spider mites because they like dry weather. But if you look underneath the leaf and bring your magnifying glass, you may find that is what is going on. The feeding of those insects can cause that. Another possibility is herbicide damage. We're seeing quite a lot of that this year. That can cause twisted and curled leaves as well. But usually you're going to see it most on the new growth. So if it's the whole plant that is showing the symptoms, I'd be leaning more towards an insect problem. Maybe Brian has more input.
Are the plants flowering okay? Do the flowers look all right?
Oh, they don't flower yet. They flower okay. a little bit later.
Okay. I would watch them.
I had looked it up, and I had there was two remedies. One was neem oil, and the other was insecticidal soap.
That would indicate an insect problem, most likely.
Yeah.
If those are the recommendations. But I would check for the insects to make sure they're there before you do any treatments.
Yeah.
It's usually not a great idea to apply things if you don't have an indication that the pest is there.
Yeah. Yeah. Good points. Joan, thank you for calling. Linda in Wausau emailed, every year the leaves on her hawthorn tree start out healthy, but around June, some of the leaves stay healthy, half green. The other half is dark brown and dead. What could be doing that?
Lisa, you want to, you have an idea on that one? I have one if you don't.
You can go for it.
My guess is it's probably an insect problem. It's probably leaf miner. There's a leaf miner that occurs on hawthorns that will typically cause browning of a part of the leaf. And that would be something where I would get in contact, take some photos and send those to PJ Leash, who is my equivalent in the Department of Entomology. He runs the insect diagnostic lab, and take some close-ups of the leaves and send them to him. And he should be able to tell you whether or not it's that particular insect. But we had a case of that come through. Somebody sent me some photos and thought it was a disease. And right away, when I looked at it, it was like, I'm betting that's leaf miner.
And quickly, if we can, a listener emailed to ask if you could comment on commercial pesticide drift. Many of her plants, different kinds of plants, showed curled brown yellow leaves. Not dead, often needlepoint little brown dots. They're okay, but the farmer's convinced her plants have fungus or mold, saying that his spray only shows the first signs of dying in his field after 3 days. Her plants show these effects within hours to 24 hours. Any comments on that?
I would contact DatCap's Driftwatch program. You can, you know, explain what's going on. You can send them photos. If it is a commercial entity that is causing problems, then they can help you with that.
And on that note, thank you both. It's always fun to have the two of you with us, and we'll look forward to having you back soon. Thanks, Lisa, and thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. He's in the Department of Plant Pathology. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at what's being done to give you the best roses possible on your landscape. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, roses are a beautiful addition to almost any garden, but some varieties can be difficult to grow. And up next, we're going to be talking about work that's being done to make roses more sustainable. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk, and great to have David Zlizak back to talk with us. He's a professor of horticulture in the Plant and Earth Science Department at UW River Falls, is involved in the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. And we're going to find out more about it. And, of course, take your rose questions as we go along here during this segment. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. David Zlizak, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's great to be back with you and the listeners.
You are involved in the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. Tell us about that program.
Yeah, I'd love to. So it's short. Or the short name is ARTS, the ARTS program, to make it simpler. So in 2012, the All-America Rose Selection Program, which used to be the premier national trial, disbanded. It started in 1938, and it was industry-led, and roses were trialed across the country, and winner takes all, the best above average rose everywhere is what a lot of marketing dollars was put behind. And a number of colleagues and I have been running low-maintenance rose trials as part of the EarthKind program, seeing what roses are regionally adapted to local pest, disease, climate factors. And so with the disbanding of All-America Rose Selection and them maybe being a little slow to the gate in terms of not spraying their test roses with fungicides early enough, because people want low maintenance roses, some of the last winners weren't necessarily the healthiest, and their impact in the marketplace began to decline. So a number of us already doing low maintenance sustainable rose trials recognize that there is this need. And we took core components of our more extensive scientific long-term trialing process and created a shorter-term two-year trial, and have trial sites across the country. And instead of a winner-take-all approach, which doesn't make sense because the same plant doesn't do well everywhere with all the different crops that we love to grow, that we have regional awards. And the regions that we use for the roses is what ecologists use, a Köppen climate system, which takes into account not only temperature, but precipitation, which is important for a lot of the diseases and insects and those pressures. So we use a Köppen climate system that a lot of gardeners may be less familiar with than the USDA cold hardiness zones, but it's more representative, it's more informative than the USDA cold hardiness zones. So we have regional award-winning roses, and the message ultimately is these roses were grown without preventative fungicides, insecticides. They were monitored monthly throughout the growing season for 2 years, and they're compared with market standards. So we know year by year the climate can be different. We're getting a lot of rain this year. So we always plant two leading market standard roses, Double Knockout and Sunrise Sunset, and any trial rose that scores equal or better at the end of the two-year process earns an award. And so homeowners, landscapers can have confidence that given basic plant care, these roses should be highly likely to be successful in our gardens.
Well, it seems like a great way to go about it. And we have the zones or sites here. We have a couple of zones, I guess you could call it. I hate to use the term zone. I don't think you're using zone as a term, but maybe you are.
So instead of a zone like the USDA cold hardiness zone, these are climatic regions.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. I could share a tiny bit about zones for comparing and contrasting, and there's no one metric that totally encompasses everything that we need to know as gardeners. Will a plant grow well here or not? But the cold hardiness zone map has been useful for us because cold is often a major factor that leads to plant injury. But I'd love for people to think about plant injury over winter from this perspective. As we go from August to September to October, plants harden off. And what does that mean? That means that they're able to tolerate colder and colder temperatures before they're injured. And then plants are able to tolerate the coldest temperature throughout the year, typically in mid-January. That's when they're the most hardened off. And then they begin to deacclimate, tolerating warmer and warmer temperatures before this injury until spring. So we have this curve at which, what's the minimum temperature that they could still survive? It gets lower and lower to mid-January, and then they come back out. Anytime the actual temperature falls below that curve, we have plant injury. And we could have a lot of plant injury in the fall and in the spring with temperatures that aren't super cold from our perspective, but they fall below what the plant can tolerate. So with you know, climatic up and downs that we're experiencing, especially in the fall and the spring, that could be when our plants get the most injury, actually. We ultimately, for our region, need plants that go to bed early, sleep soundly, and wake up late. So that's at least my perspective towards cold hardiness. I take less stock in them than other people. But the Köppen climate system, which takes into account not only temperature, but also moisture, is really important. Climate specialists, conservationists have used it for years, knowing that those factors impact disease and insect pressure too.
Well, according to the maps on the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program, the website, which I think is a good one, and if you're interested in roses, you ought to be paying attention to the site. We have Wisconsin divided into the humid, cool summer group and the humid, hot summer group. And I think the humid, cold summer group, does that take up the most? Yeah, that takes up, I think, about three quarters of the state almost.
Yeah, yeah, the northern three quarters, and that's where I live. And then the southern quarter, Milwaukee through about the Madison area, it looks like, and then west to, you know, Platteville and the southwest region is the a bit warmer summer group, yeah.
And you used the zones in a way. You used temperature and you used humidity in coming up with these groups.
Yeah, the climate specialists have. So this system's been in place for over 100 years, the Köppen climate system. So we're not recreating the wheel. We're just leveraging what others that went before us have created.
And the trials take place. I was looking at Wisconsin. There are trials taking place. Talk about where they are taking place.
Yeah, great question. So we're grateful for botanical gardens, arboretums, extension offices with horticulture extension agents that host these trials. So after All America Rose Selection disbanded, they had high entry fees and a big marketing push that cost a lot of money. A lot of the nurseries felt kind of burned and they didn't have as much money anymore to invest in things like that. So our work is basically on a shoestring budget. So we have very modest entry fees because we want all the nurseries that want to enter their roses to enter them. And we leverage the generosity of wonderful volunteers, additional volunteers. I'm a volunteer. I'm the president right now of Arts to make these trials possible. So we have a trial site at Green Bay Botanical Garden, as well as Berner Botanical Garden. And these two sites, we get new entries every year, but the plants are followed through for 2 years. So they don't have enough space to house simultaneous trials, one set of roses in year one, the other in year two. So they're sister gardens. So they leapfrog every other year. They take the set of roses, but they represent our Wisconsin area. And then there's additional trial sites in South Dakota at Brookings, University of Minnesota and Crookston area used to host a site years ago, and then Moorhead area. So Ryman Gardens at Iowa State University host a site, Chicago Botanic Gardens, which might be closer to some of the listeners that live in southern Wisconsin to come and visit. They're a trial site too, but that's for the DFA or the southern quarter of the state, that region, the Chicago Botanic Gardens. So we have trial sites and partners across the country. Our goal is to ultimately have two trial sites at least in each of the different Köppen climate regions, and there's about eight or nine throughout the U.S. Some are larger than others, but and we're working towards that goal. Many of the regions are already there.
Our guest today, David Zlezak, is a professor of horticulture in the Plant and Earth Sciences Department at UW River Falls, telling us about the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program, or ARTS is a nice acronym for sure. Great to have him with us today. Questions for him about the program or maybe about roses, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and WPR News. Thanks to everybody who donated during our June member drive. You know, support from people like Roger in Milwaukee and Patrick in Verona and Stefana in Vesper. Lots of people contributed to really help make WPR possible. If you missed joining in, there's still time at WPR.org/donate. When you do, hey, we've got a WPR bucket hat for $20 a month, or you can get a WPR camp mug for $30 a month. Whatever amount, though, you play an important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. I want to thank you for your partnership. And again, if you want to donate, go to WPR.org/donate. Right now, we're talking with David Zlezak, who is a professor of horticulture in the Plant and Earth Science Department at UW River Falls. We've been zeroing in on the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program, or the ARTS program. And if you have questions about that, or maybe just questions about the roses that you have in on your own property, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Veronica emails wondering what kind of fertilizer she should be giving her roses. They don't seem to get very big, and they look kind of spindly.
Oh, that's a great question, Veronica. Maybe before we brainstorm that question, I just love to leave people with the idea. If you go to the website, the ARTS website, there's a shorter URL that gets you there, just trustedroses.org. And one of the top links that you could click on is the map, and then you can see which region that you're in, and then click on the square to the left associated with that region, and you can see a list of all the winning roses for your region. So that's a really easy, nice resource to go to. So for fertilizer, what I love to do, and I'll share a quick little story, is always starting with a soil test is really wise. Maybe about 30 years ago when I was in college, moved the roses. My family, my parents moved when I was in college, and I dug up the garden and moved it. And after a couple years, the roses just weren't growing as well at the new place. And I was, you know, throwing fertilizer at them, well-balanced fertilizers, everything. And they were still, you know, kind of suffering. And then I broke down and mailed in a soil sample, and all I needed was potassium. And I put some muriate of potash down, and things were fine. So I know sometimes it's, you know, people just want a quick fix and just do something and have it over with, but just a quick soil test and knowing what your soil has, what you need, would be really helpful.
And it also, when you send in the soil test, you can say, well, I'm growing roses on this property or whatever you're growing.
Yeah. And then they'll make the recommendation targeted for the crop. That's amazing. Yeah, so what we'll always need to, or it's helpful to add some nitrogen because the nitrogen cycle, it goes through the system. So personally, because I have oodles of roses at home. Wait, I don't even know how many I have. I have thousands of roses, 2 acres of roses. I have a limited budget. So I use just 10-10-10, just cheaper regular garden fertilizer. I've had a soil test done when I first moved in to my current place. A few years ago, I should have one again. But then I just use that just to keep things going. But, you know, if you add a balanced fertilizer just to get things through, if they're suffering a little bit right now, and then have that soil test done and make your corrections in response to the recommendations, that would be a good approach.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we've had a lot of rain recently, and what kinds of issues come up with roses during these sorts of conditions, and what can we do to keep them healthy?
Yeah, great question. So some of the fungal diseases tend to take off, and the roses that are more susceptible tend to defoliate more. So rose black spot, I'm excited to have some funding with the American Rose Society this summer to continue some of the work that myself and colleagues at University of Minnesota have been doing with identifying black spot resistance genes in roses so breeders can more strategically accumulate multiple genes in single plants. So rose black spot needs 6 to 8 hours of free moisture, which we can get with these rainstorms, dew at night, for the spores to penetrate and take hold. So rose black spot is out there. I've had some downy mildew this spring, which it's not a true fungus. It's an oomycete or water mold. And when it's cool and wet, that could take off a little bit. So some above average fungal diseases, but with all the moisture, plants are growing real strong, which is great to see compared to years past with the drought. So even though there's some disease building a bit, it's just great to see plants really growing quick and being happy again.
Yeah, for sure. As you look at the areas that we have here, the hot summer, the humid hot summer group, and the humid cool summer group, do you have some, maybe take a look at some of your favorite roses from those areas and talk about those roses and in those conditions?
Yeah, that's a great question. So myself, I grew up in the Milwaukee area, and when I was a kid, I loved gardening and science, and Will Rattler, who's the breeder of the knockout roses when I was 13, I wrote to him, and he wrote back to me and got me started breeding roses. At that point, I thought, you know, I could grow anything. The big, gorgeous hybrid tea roses, I'll spray them, I'll insulate them for winter. And then when they still got disease and I still lost some from winter, I realized sustainable roses are important. And so over the years here, the good, hardy, faithful roses that tend to hold up in old farm sites and places especially still capture my attention. Some of those faithful ones are Thérèse Bounet, which came out in the 1950s, hardy to the tip through most all the state. It has a little bit of our native Rosa Blanda in it, fragrant, red-tinted canes during the winter, just like our native Rosa Blanda. So that's a good one. Frau Dagmar Hestrop, the older Gosa, beautiful mounded plant habit, healthy foliage, big hips, big single, soft pink blooms. Those are faithful ones. A lot of the Agriculture Canada roses bred by Dr. Felicitas Veda, named after North American explorers, many of those are still holding up and in doing well. I've been breeding roses mainly in a limited capacity over the years just at home. And a lot of my breeding is to create interesting hybrids and bring unique genetics together for the pathology work that I do. But one of those seedlings that came out above and beyond is basically like a explorer climber, but in an apricot kind of orange colored bud. So it brings warm colors into a big hardy, cane hardy climber like a William Baffin, which is pink. There's some wonderful newer roses. So through Bailey's Oscar Peterson, which was bred up in Morden, Manitoba, it won an arts award. Is a good faithful rose that's a creamy white and lots of buds, pretty winter hardy, maybe a little bit of powdery mildew at times, but not bad. Otherwise, very healthy. Campfire, beautiful range of colors. It's also from Agriculture Canada and Morden, Manitoba. So those are just a few of the many that I just adore.
So when you say you're doing this at home under limited conditions, what does it take to get involved? You know, what do you do when in this whole process of breeding?
Yeah, great question. So I make control crosses. I collect anthers before they release their pollen and store them in little film canisters, let them dry, and then I cap them and freeze them. I could store them for over a year that way, and then I'll pull out the little capsules with who I want to be the daddy for the day and go out there and emasculate some of the female blooms and put the pollen of where I want to be the dad and mark them. I have lots of plant stands in my walkout basement, so I start lots of new seedlings every spring and get them planted out in the garden and just see what they do. You have these families of seedlings, and everyone's different, even though they're full siblings, just like our families. And then I learn about them and see which ones inherited more disease resistance, more hardiness, different colors. I'm more concerned about a hardy, healthy plant first, and then hopefully see if they're pretty after that. But so I have a lot of hardy monsters at home that may be mediocre for floral quality.
But but this process isn't just 1 year. This must take some time, you know, to develop.
Yeah, it's a way of life. I've been breeding roses for over 35 years now, so it's always fun. I just keep learning, and then eventually there's something unique, and with colleagues we try to figure out, okay, this rose has unique disease resistance. What's up with that? What genes are behind that? So it makes it really rewarding and fun.
And your whole, I want to go back and make sure that people are familiar with this American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. Again, this is something that I think is really valuable for anybody who's interested in growing roses. So go over again what people can get from this.
Yeah, great question. So ultimately, our goal is to provide recommendations of roses that do well in each of the regions based on objective scientific data collection. So the trials are open to, you know, any breeder nursery to enter their roses, and how awards are given is really straightforward and transparent. If the entry score is equal or greater than the average of our two trial market standard roses that are planted in every planting, Double Knockout and Sunrise Sunset, it earns an award. So the goal then is, you know, with basic plant care, you'll be highly likely to be successful with these roses. And if no rose meets that standard this year, none win for that region. If five of them win, great, they all get awards. So it's fair for all the nurseries, and any deserving rose is honored.
And is there a way for people to identify? I mean, they go to trustedroses.org, and they'll find the roses.
Yeah. Yep. So with all these different nurseries and their branding programs and what they want to have on their labels and tags, we share with them a logo that they could put on their tags. A lot of them don't, because they have their own marketing, or they don't want to, you know, take extra space, and not every rose is a winner. So they don't want to, oh, well, people will see, well, this one's not a winner, but we still want to sell it. So the best thing to do is just go to our website and see what varieties are the best for your region, and look for them.
And why the heck do roses have thorns? Dennis wants to know.
That's a great question. The rabbits chew right through them sometimes, don't they? And the deer, so they're not 100% effective. I don't know.
Well, they probably grew that way so that the rabbits couldn't get at them so much. But David, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much, and we'll visit again. Thank you, David. David Zlizak, Professor of Horticulture in the Plant and Earth Sciences Department at UW River Falls. Thanks to him, and thanks to our whole team, producers Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store.